Dr. Adrian is a PhD student at Daniel Loss Group in Basel. And before that, he did his master thesis officially at ETH Zurich under the Arthur Renners Group, but he worked with Stefanie Wehner in Singapore. And it's a bit unusual and really interesting because in that time he already got some really interesting results on statistical physics and quantum information in his master's thesis. Yeah, and I think we'll hear about that in the talk.
Okay, thank you, Markus. Let me start my talk with some background. As you know, statistical physics is more than 100 years old, but there were some questions which remained open throughout the past years in a purely classical framework. And now in the previous years, there has been enormous progress when people try to derive these principles of statistical physics directly from first principles from the very structure of quantum mechanics. And what I will talk about in this talk is I will first present a theorem, which is purely quantum information theoretical. And this theorem then is basically so powerful that it allows us to rederive some of the major results which have been obtained in previous years, basically in back of the envelope calculations. So this will be this theorem, a more technical part. Then in the second part, we will rederive those results and see how we can not only rederive them, but also generalize those results. And then in the third part, I will use again this same theorem from the first part to address some open problems. Okay, in order to express this theorem, I need to introduce these entropic quantities. Why do we use entropic quantities in quantum information theory? Well, the main reason is that they allow us to bound operational quantities. That is, they tell us how good we can do a certain task. And in this sense, the von Neumann entropy is mainly relevant in IID scenarios where you have a large number of identical resources, or the same state a large number of times. So if we restrict to cases where you have to perform a certain task only one time or a few times, the relevant entropic quantities, which were developed by an Arthur Renner co-workers, like Roger Kobach, are the smooth entropy measures, the min and the max entropy. And let me very briefly present you some key features of these entropy measures. They feature such as smoothing parameter epsilon, which makes them insensitive to small variations of the underlying state rho. This basically means that you do not have to count states which are highly untypical. Then a second point, if the smoothing parameter is sufficiently small, then the mean entropy is always smaller than the von Neumann entropy, and the max entropy always larger, and hence the names. And the third point, if you really do have an IID scenario, then both of these entropy measures reduce to the von Neumann entropy. So in this sense, these entropy measures are strictly more general than the von Neumann entropy. Okay, so here goes our theorem. The question we want to answer by use of this theorem is if we have a quantum channel, a completely positive map, and trace-preserving map, we want to answer the question whether is this channel such that almost all possible inputs yield the same output? Is this channel such that it allows for different states really yielding distinct outputs? And we can present the criterion for whether this is the case or not in terms of these entropic quantities. And they are evaluated for the Kolyam-Yolkowski state of this channel, which is just the state which you obtain if you apply this channel to a maximally entangled state between A and a copy A prime of it. Now, this is a formal version of this theorem, so let me briefly guide you through this theorem. It's basically a corollary of this decoupling theorem by Frédéric Dupuy, and then applies also some measure concentration properties of the Haar measure. And what it says is that if you choose an input state which has eigenstates which are chosen at random from the Haar measure, then the output states will, with overwhelming probability, be close to the state which you obtain if you input a uniform state. And this is the case if this is small and both this is small. And in order for this to be small, we basically need the dimension of the input space to be large. And in order for this to be small, we basically need a big zeta for a small epsilon. And this zeta here is given by this conditional mean entropy of the Kolyam-Yorkowski state. And because these conditional entropies are kind of hard to evaluate, we can lower bound this in terms of non-conditional entropies. We have a chain rule which kind of mimics the corresponding condition, the corresponding equation for the von Neumann entropy. This is always larger than this difference of non-conditional entropies. So because this theorem is somewhat involved, I will apply an informal version of the theorem, which just says this term theta, which we saw has to be large for a small epsilon. So informally, we will say that a channel is such that it yields the same outputs for almost all possible inputs if this entropy, the total entropy of the Kolyam-Yorkowski state, is larger than the entropy of the output part alone. And we also show a converse theorem, which I shall briefly sketch here, which says just that if the opposite condition is true, then the channel allows for different input states to yield distinct outputs. So you see that this condition is basically tied up to differences between these two entropy measures. Maybe it helps to understand this if we apply it to kind of the two easiest channels you can think of, which are also the true extreme channels. One of them is the trivial channel, or the identity channel, which just outputs the input. Then the Kolyam-Yorkowski state is just the maximally entangled state between A prime and B. So this is zero, whereas this is maximal or log of dimension of A. So then this condition is maximally fulfilled. And the other extreme case is an erasure channel, which just outputs some state zero for every possible input state. Then the Kolyam-Yorkowski state is zero on B and maximally mixed on A prime, so that then this condition is maximally satisfied. So let's now turn to the second part. The basic principle of statistical physics is this postulate of equal a priori probabilities. Here's a textbook version of this postulate, which says that in equilibrium, an isolated system occupies every accessible state with equal probabilities. So in order to describe this with quantum mechanical terms, we consider a tensor product space of one part which we call kind of the actual system and one part which we call the environment. And we consider some subspace omega of this tensor product space. And this subspace describes this space of accessible microspace states, which usually is the space of all states within some narrow energy interval. Then there was in 2006 this Nature paper by these three gentlemen, where they gave sufficient conditions for this space being such that almost all states from it appear to fulfill the postulate. That is, what they show is namely that if this space is dimension-wise sufficiently larger than the space S, then almost all states from it are such that if you trace out the environment, you obtain the same state on S as if you let me write it down. For almost all states C psi in this space omega are such that if you trace out the environment, you obtain basically the same as if you trace out the environment of a maximally mixed state on omega. And this kind of describes the state which follows the postulate. So what they show is that really from using only this tensor product structure, we can derive why most states of such a space appear to follow the postulate. Yes. And yeah, but it's important as if they fulfilled, because only on S they look identical. Of course, it's not the case that most states are really this maximally mixed state. So let us now see what we can do here with the theorem I've presented before. The channel, the relevant channel, is here a very simple one. It is just the channel which takes input states from this space omega, output state on S, and does nothing more than trace out the environment. So, and in order to show you how simple all of this is, let me do it on the blackboard. So the theorem says that we have to evaluate those entropies for the Kolyapakovsky state of this channel, which is then given by this partial trace of the maximal entangled state across the input space omega and the copy of it. And the theorem says that we have to evaluate this difference. And now you can we note that by construction, this state is purified by this maximal entangled state. And because the entropies only depend on the eigenvalues, we see from the Schmidt decomposition that the entropies are identical on both sides of a pure state. So this is the same like yes, and then we see that we only need entropies on E and on S. That is, we do not need the omega prime part. And we only need the state basically on omega, and the partial trace of this maximal entangled state is just the maximally mixed state. So that we obtain this criterion, which says, again, almost all states restricted to the space omega are such that if we trace out the environment, we obtain this state, which seems to fulfill this postulate. If the entropy in the environment of this maximally mixed state is larger than the entropy in S of it. And the converse yields then following basically the same steps, that it is not the case if the entropy in S is larger than the entropy in E. So we have a basically tight criterion for whether a space omega is such that most states from it seem to follow this postulate or not. And then it may intuitively be clear that if the space omega is much larger than S, then this condition is always fulfilled, because this condition kind of measures how much the space omega is weighted towards the two tensor factors. And this can indeed be made rigorous. It's also very simple. We can namely lower bound this if we use a subadditivity property of those entropy measures, and in order to lower bound this, we can apply some chain rule, which says that this is larger than the total entropy minus log of dimension of S. And of course, the entropy in S is also upper bounded by log dS. And because the state you're interested in is the maximally mixed state on omega, this term here is the log of the dimension of omega. So we obtain this lower bound in terms of only dimensional quantities. And this is exactly what they have derived. So we have kind of two conditions, one which is basically tight in terms of entropic quantities, and one in terms of dimensional, in terms of dimensions. Yes. So, and one benefit of applying this theorem is that we can not only rederive the result of Fourpest Quetal, we can only give it more sense in the following sense. In order to apply this theorem, which is based on this decoupling theorem, we do actually not need the full structure of the Haar measure, but we only need its first and second, its first two moments. And we do not even need the exact moments, but only need that they are approximated. So approximate two designs are in fact sufficient in order to apply our theorem. And then there was a result by Aram Harrow and R. Lowe, I don't know what his first name is, where they showed that if you have n qubits and you randomly apply two qubit gates to those two pairs of qubits, then you efficiently obtain an approximate two design. So this allows us then to replace this Haar measure, which is sometimes criticized for being not physical, by something truly constructive. Yes?
Can you only need the first two moments and not the first, say, four moments? Or
it comes out of the derivation of this.
I mean, this is for which quantity? For this relative entropy?
Sorry?
Is it for the relative entropy?
No, it hasn't. I don't think it has directly to do with the entropy, but in the derivation of the theorem which I showed at the beginning, you only need polynomials of second order.
Okay.
Okay, so let's come to the second and the third part of the talk. There was a second paper by basically the same authors plus Noam Linden, which was called quantum mechanical evolution towards thermal equilibrium. And in this paper, they point out that this straightforward looking process of thermalization may actually be broken down into independent aspects. And two of these aspects are that in order for us to say that a system thermalizes, it has to become independent of its own initial state, and it also shall not depend on the precise initial state of the environment, but only on macroscopic properties of the environment, like temperature. So the final equilibrium state, indeed, shall not depend on the precise microstate of the environment, yeah, but only on macroscopic properties like temperature. And second, if the system is much smaller than the environment, we expect the initial state of the system basically to be irrelevant. And they derive indeed sufficient conditions for these two things to be the case, but they only then make statements about the equilibrium state of the system. They never make statements about the evolved state of the system at some given time t. And correspondingly, they do not make statements about the time scales which are necessary for such thermalization processes to happen. And indeed, deriving time scales for such thermalization processes in quantum mechanical system remains one of the big open problems in this whole project of deriving statistical physics from quantum mechanics. So let us again see what we can do here if we apply our theorem. We consider for simplicity a product pure initial state. In fact, we do not have to restrict to product states or the pure states, but let's just for the moment do this for simplicity. We assume that the initial state of the system follows certain restrictions, which we describe by a linear subspace, and similarly, the initial state of the environment. And then the two questions we are interested in are these. Given the initial state of the environment and the Hamiltonian, how long does it take for different states of the subspace to evolve to the same state, if this happens at all? Because we expect that if you let your cup of coffee stand on a table for enough time, then after some time it approaches a state which does not depend on the details of the initial state, like the momenta of different molecules and the temperature, but that it just approaches a thermal state which only depends on the temperature of the environment. And the second question, given the initial state of the system, when is it such that indeed almost all those initial states of the environment which follow the same constraints lead to the same evolved state of the system? Now we can just write down the evolved state of the system. We have this pure initial product state, then it evolves unitarily, and then we trace out the environment. And now note that we can look at this as a quantum channel. We can look at it either as a channel which takes input states from the space S bar and goes to S, so it takes the initial state of the system as an input. Or we can look at it as a channel which takes this input state, this initial state of the environment as an input. So we have two possible channels, and to both of these channels we can apply our theorem. Now, what comes out of the theorem, I will now just sketch the result, but the derivation is really at the same level of what I've showed here before. The theorem tells us that we should consider this state here, which is given by a state which is initially maximally mixed on this subspace of the system, and the initial state of the environment, and then evolved unitarily. So this is not one of the states we are actually interested in, because it's not pure on the system. But the theorem tells us that if we understand how this state evolves, then we can make statements about how generic initial states of this product form evolve. So it reduces kind of the problem to the study of just one particular state. Now note that at t equals zero, we have maximal entropy here in this system subspace and zero entropy in the environment. Now what comes out of the theorem is that as long as the entropy in the system is still larger than the entropy in the environment, then we can still kind of distinguish different evolved states. So the system still has some memory about its initial state. And conversely, if at any time the entropy in the environment has become larger than the entropy in the system, then almost all initial states from the subspace will have evolved to the same state, namely to just a partial trace of this space, this state up here. So this basically reduces this question of how these different initial states evolve to the same state to the study of entropy changes. And this also allows us to see some connection. In this paper by Linden et al., they show that the equilibrium state of the system will be independent of the system's own initial state if the energy eigenstates between S and D are sufficiently entangled. And here we see that if the energy eigenstates are sufficiently entangled, this will lead to entropy production in the environment, which will then lead to this condition finally being satisfied, so that indeed we see that most states will then have evolved to the same state. What is maybe also important to note is that we do not make here any statement about what this state looks like, nor do we predict that it approaches an equilibrium state. The only thing we are interested in here is whether the system has already kind of forgotten about its initial state or not. And we can again lower bound these dimensional terms in terms of lower bound the entropic terms in terms of dimensions. And what we found is that this difference here is larger than this. So we see that if that the environment is dimension-wise sufficiently larger than the system, sufficiently smaller than the system, which we of course not expect in physical scenarios, because we usually think of the environment being much larger than the system. But if the environment is much larger than the system, then it can never erase it, because it just doesn't have enough degrees of freedom to absorb all the information in the initial state. Okay, now let's go to the second problem. When does the initial state, when does the evolved state of the system sensibly depend on the initial state of the environment? Or when does it only depend on the macroscopic properties of the initial state of the environment? And we can here again derive conditions in terms of entropic quantities, but let's directly go to the dimensional conditions. Namely, we see that if this restricted environment is dimension-wise sufficiently larger than the system, which we usually expect to be the case in physical scenarios, then almost all such states from this subspace will at any time and for any possible Hamiltonian will yield the same evolved state of the system. Which means that indeed, for almost all possible initial states of the environment with the same macroscopic properties, the evolution of the system will be the same. Also note that this almost all here is not just a technicality, because we can easily think of real life scenarios where we do get a distinct evolution of the system if the difference, if the initial state of the environment is different. So what the theorem says is, for example, almost all initial states of the environment with the same temperature lead to the same evolution of the system. But if there is a bomb in the environment, this will lead to a distinct evolution of the system. So, but what the theorem basically says is that the Hausmeier fraction of initial environment states that do lead to a distinct evolution is vanishingly small. Yes. Okay, one thing which is also interesting is that this condition is basically the same which Linden et al. Found, but they predict then, given that this is the case, they predict that the equilibrium state will be the same for almost all such initial states. And because we predict that it will be the case at any given time t, this is actually a strictly stronger result. Okay, so that is the last slide. Let us now turn to the study of timescales, the timescales which are involved in such thermalization processes, we have seen that as long as if we have a state which is initially maxed, fully maximally maxed in this system subspace, then as long as this is fulfilled, we know that the system has not yet become independent of its own initial state and hence has not yet thermalized. So if we can guarantee for some time that this equation or this inequality is satisfied, then we know that the system has not yet, that we have a lower bound on the thermalization time of the system. So the next step is then to bound the maximal rate with which these entropic quantities are, can change. And so far we have not made any assumptions whatsoever on what this system looks like or what the Hamiltonian looks like. And of course, if we want to bound the rate with which these entropies can change, this crucially depends on such assumptions. For example, yeah, if we usually expect that we only have local interactions, and then this, of course, slows down the possible changes of entropy. And it also depends on geometrical things, like, for example, if the interaction surface between S and D is larger, we expect that changes of the local entropies can happen faster. So all these things need to be taken into account. But here we derive one bound, which even holds in the most general case, where we do not make any restrictions whatsoever. We find then that we need at least a time which is inverse to the, with h int, I mean just the interactive part of the Hamiltonian, because the local parts lead to unitaries on S and D alone and do not produce entanglement. So we need at least a time which is inverse to the interaction strength of the Hamiltonian, which is basically trivial, and maybe a little less trivial. Also, this, the inverse of this commutator gives a lower bound on the thermalization time. And I think as if you do not impose any restrictions on the Hamiltonian, this is basically as far as you can get. But of course, if we do impose locality assumptions, then of course we expect to find much better bounds. Even though we can show by use of a toy example that this bound here is basically tight, it is indeed possible that almost all states from some subspace evolve to the same state in times of this time scale. But again, for realistic physical Hamiltonians with local interactions, we expect to find much better bounds, because then we can apply these Lieb-Robinson type bounds. So I think the main merit of this bound here is that it allows us to then apply such bounds to bound the rates with which entropies can change, and then find rigorous lower bounds on thermalization timescales. So what I would expect, for example, to hold is that if you have some qubit lattice and S is just a subset of these qubits, then one can show that the time it takes for such a system to thermalize is basically given by the linear size of the system divided by the Lieb-Robinson velocity. But to my knowledge, no such results exist so far. And I guess it should be possible using this criterion to derive something like that. Okay, with that I'm already done. These are the main entropies, the main references we've used in this Nature paper, then 1 or 3 years later, and from this theorem we have basically, from this paper we have basically the theorem which we have applied. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks for the nice talk. So are there questions? So can you say something about these toy examples that show that this bound is tight?
Yeah, it's really...
Are they kind of trivial?
I mean, you just have yeah, you have a, you we have used the environment which is just a copy of the system, and then energy eigenstates EK, which are just something like that for different eyes. So yeah, we just have a tonian which just turns the contents of S into E in constant time. So really nothing which is physically relevant, but just to prove that the bound is tight.
More questions?
Yeah. How do you know that the quantum model is required to explain thermalization? A quantum model is required. I mean, how do you know that? I mean, can you imagine that a classical model can also explain a kind of thermalization? Or
I guess it depends on what kind of system you have in mind. If you really consider a qubit lattice or a spin lattice, a lattice of quantum mechanical spins, then you have by construction a system which needs a quantum mechanical explanation.
Yeah,
I mean, of course, people have explained thermalization of purely classical systems for decades, but...
Yeah, but because in your explanation it looks that entanglement is the main, entanglement between your system and...
That's my explanation, it has been...
Yeah, but what's the justification for this? How do you know that, I mean, if a classical, in a classical model, maybe, I mean, you have, you need a model, I mean, maybe this entanglement is not responsible for that thermalization, maybe just a classical model explained that.
Yeah, but I really think that this, for example, yeah, this postulate of a priori probabilities was really just in the classical framework, was just a postulate, and it's really nice that they were able to show that you basically only need the tensor product structure, nothing more, and then it comes out really naturally if you just use this very basic structure of quantum mechanics. So this is, I think, these 2 points, you can put it on the more solid footing, and they're really the purely classical statistical physics, and the second one, if you really consider genuinely quantum mechanical systems, then of course you need a quantum mechanical theory of thermalization.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that necessarily the entanglement between your system and environment is responsible for thermalization. I mean, you need a quantum treatment, but it doesn't mean entanglement explained.
Well, I mean, if their systems are coupled, the only way you wouldn't have entanglement is if they're both so highly mixed that you're kind of inside the separable ball or something. It's hard to have systems couple and not become entangled, right?
Yeah, but I mean...
The idea is the overall system is pure, that's the assumption. And when you partial trace out the environment, you have a mixed state on the system, and that's supposed to be close to the canonical, the appropriate canonical ensemble, and so... I don't really see how it's even conceptually possible to not have entanglement if you're talking about a quantum mechanical model.
Well, you can have entanglement, but not, I mean, it's not clear that the entanglement is responsible for that thermal. Like, you can have some entanglement, but...
Yeah, but, I mean, this...
Because the claim is stronger than that. The claim is that any thermal, I mean, the thermal property of the state is because it's entangled with the...
I mean, this theorem about whether the different initial states are still distinguishable or not, I think it's basically tight. And in order to produce entropy in the environment, you need entangled energy eigenstates. By, yeah. Otherwise, the entropy in this criterion, the entropy in S will for all times be larger than the entropy in E. So it will never be possible that different initial states evolve to the same state.
classically, if you start pure, right, then it just stays pure, even locally. So, right, in a way, this, unless you have stochastic dynamics, Hamiltonian.
I never know what pure means classically. What do you mean by pure?
Probability one on a singular configuration.
Direct delta functions?
Yes. Yeah, or discrete.
Yeah, I'm gonna, so coming back to that question I asked earlier, I didn't quite, couldn't make sense of your answer. I mean, I was just asking, I mean, the idea is you start by assuming you have hard random states, and then you show that the reduced density matrix is somehow close enough to the one you get by assuming you have the identity state. But it's that idea of what's close enough, like what's your criterion for close enough, and what's the criterion you're using for which a two design is sufficient?
Go back to the very first. Yeah, you want to show something like that,
right,
with a small term, with small terms on the right hand side, and you can also obtain small terms which are slightly different if you do not have the Haar measure, but only an approximate 2D
So this is the one norm distance, I guess.
Right, yeah.
On this, sorry, so tau is the, you use the Choi-Jamal-Kaut, I mean, using the...
Exactly.
So it's the one norm on this virtual state on a bigger space. Okay.
What, because, I mean, this is on the B space, the one norm.
It's just the output of the channel, right?
Right. Okay, thanks.
More questions? So I have a question on the time scales. You have lower bounds, right? Is there any hope for upper bounds?
Yeah, I think it's definitely much more difficult to prove that something happens rather than it has not yet happened. I have no idea, and I don't know about the results.
No questions. Yeah, let's thank Adrian again.